There's one of my favourite stories from that young child. And he said that once there was this man who was walking in the forest, and he saw there was a hole. And at the bottom of the hole, there was a treasure. And he leant over and tried to pick out the treasure, but his arm couldn't reach it, it was a bit too deep. And he stretched and stretched and still couldn't reach it, and after a while he just gave up. And he met another man, he said, there's a treasure in that hole, but the hole is too deep. And so that man went away. And the second man thought, how stupid that man is. It's not that the hole is deep, too deep. His arm is too short. So he lengthened his arm with a stick and could hook all the treasure out. So it wasn't that the hole was too deep. It was that his arm was too short. So, lengthen your arm. So you may say, oh, the letters are too small. No, you come closer. Okay, so that is some dumb. Can you see it okay? No? Everybody? Okay. So this is going to be by request every afternoon at 3 p.m. Some of the suttas, which are the words of the Buddha. And so for the next 7 days, I think I just counted, we're going to be going through the compilation of suttas about the Eightfold Path, just core Buddhist teachings. And this translation is straight from the Pali, done by none other than yours truly, Ajahn Donut. That's my name. Visit Ajahn Donut is because I'm round, I'm sweet, and I'm holy. Like a donut. So anyway, so this is a new translation, making it more up to date and more accurate as well. So this is the noble truth or the way leading to cessation of suffering. There are these two extremes that should be avoided. The pursuit of happiness through the five senses, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble and beneficial. And I use the, in brackets there, the word for low is hina, which is where we get the word hinayana from. But in Pali, the word hina means something which is people who live a life addicted to sensory pleasures. And the other extreme is the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and mind, which is painful, ignoble, and beneficial. This is the famous middle way. And it's either the pursuit of happiness through the five senses or the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body. And you see straight away there the pursuit of happiness through the sixth sense, the mind, is not included here. And later on you'll find that that is part of the path. The happiness of the mind, the inspiration, the joy of giving to other people, the joy of kindness, and the deep pleasures of a peaceful still mind. Pursuing that pleasure is not part of the first extreme. And the second extreme, practices that fatigue the body and mind, such as sitting cross-legged on the floor in a position which you're not used to. That gives you a lot of physical pain, and also you get tired out. So there's an important understanding of the eightfold, of the middle way. You look after your body and you energize the mind rather than making it tired. Which is one of the reasons why you have nice rooms, nice beds, where you can rest. Without going to either of these extremes, the Buddha has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, wisdom, peace, understanding, enlightenment, and to Nibbana. Scroll, my friend. It is this noble eightfold path, right view, right motivation. Sometimes you hear right thought, right intention. I've translated as right motivation, which you'll get see why in a probably tomorrow. right speech, right action, right livelihood, right endeavor instead of right effort, right mindfulness, and most importantly, right stillness, never right concentration. The Eightfold Path, the last path, does not mean concentration, otherwise it would be a concentration camp. It's stillness. This is that middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, wisdom, peace, understanding, enlightenment, nirvana. And the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It's a long way. Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is a right way. And this is from verse 372, Dhammapada. The Noble Eightfold Path is the best of all practices. This is the only path for purifying insight. There is no other. It's the Eightfold Path. Follow this path and you will discombobulate Mara. And discombobulate is a very rare word, but it's one of my favorite words. And just as it sounds, it means it confuses, it sort of doesn't know, Mara can't find you on that path. In other words, it's something which gets you away from Mara. So many of you, it's hard enough for you to know ordinary English. So when I put the word discombobulate, people in Australia can like that word, but it does mean like confuse. Listen, the end of dying has been reached. I shall instruct you, I shall teach you the Dharma. Practice as you are instructed by realizing for yourself in this very life. Through direct understanding, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth into monastic life, men and women, anybody. So this is the Eightfold Path, the middle way. So, right view. And many people argue between what's right view and wrong view. Wrong view. How to know right view from wrong view? First of all, after my parinirvana, after Buddha passes away, someone will think that the Dhamma has ended and you no longer have a teacher. This is wrong. After the Buddha's parinirvana, the Dhamma and the Vinaya is the rules, the training, that will be your teacher. And that was such an important statement. It meant that after the Buddha passed away, the teachings will be your teacher, not a monk, not a nun, not some big shot monk. The Dhamma is the teacher. Suppose someone were to say, friends, this is the Buddha's teaching, the Dhamma and the Vinaya, the discipline, that I heard myself from the Buddha. Then you should check this person's words with the sutras and with the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. So you don't just take what a monk or a nun or any teacher says, you check it out with the sutra and the Vinaya, see if it matches. If it agrees with the sutra and Vinaya, then you should conclude this person has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. You don't say the person is wrong, no, you just haven't understood it properly yet. Have a look again. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from a community of senior monks with distinguished teachers. Then you should check this person's words with the sutta and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the sutta and the Vinaya, then you should conclude that this community has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from many learned elders who uphold a tradition. Then you check this person's worth with the Sutta Navinia. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta Navinia, then you should conclude that these elder monks have wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from one learned elder. Then you should check this person's words with the Sutta and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and the Vinaya, then you should conclude that this learned elder has wrongly understood the teachings of the Buddha. So what that is saying, it doesn't matter how many learned monks, what their status is, even if they say they've heard it from the Buddha's own mouth, that they shouldn't just be accepted, but you should check it with the authority in the Buddhist scriptures. So, here we go. Wrong view and right view. There is such a thing said in the suttas. What now is wrong view? There are some who state whatever is called sight, hearing, smell, taste or touch, that is impermanent, unstable, non-eternal and liable to change. That's the five senses. But what is called mentality, manner or mind, chitta or consciousness, that is the permanent essence, stable, eternal, not subject to change, the same forever and ever. That is the eighth wrong view. In the Digha Nikaya, the Brahmajala Sutta, where they have the 63 wrong views. So that is specifically said to be like a wrong view by the Buddha in the first sutta, in the first collection of teachings. What now is right view? The Four Noble Truths. It is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the way of practice leading to cessation of suffering, that is called right view. The good and the bad. We don't include the ugly, just the good and the bad. Okay, somebody laughed. What are the good and the bad, and what is their cause? So this is the right view of what is moral, what is immoral. Intentional killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, malicious gossip, harsh speech, useless talk, desire relating to the five senses, ill will and wrong view, these are the bad. So you can see there's the first part of the five precepts, and instead of just lying, it's malicious gossip, spreading rumours around, harsh speech, calling someone a lazy pig. Anything which is like harsh speech, in other words, bad speech, and useless talk, and desire relating to the five senses, ill will and wrong view, these are the bad. The next one, the good. Oh, wanting, aversion and delusion. Those are the three kilesa. Oh, these are the cause of the bad. Refraining from intentionally killing living beings, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, malicious gossip, harsh speech, and from useless speech, contentment, loving kindness, and right view, this is the good. So instead of wanting, we have contentment. Instead of ill will, we have loving kindness. Instead of wrong view, we have right view, that's good. Renunciation, compassion, and wisdom are the roots of what is good. Okay, pause. Any questions? Nope.
When you say malicious gossip, does that mean there's like not malicious gossip?
Indeed, there is unmalicious gossip. If you see someone going around Jhana Grove with an axe looking to sort of kill somebody, please gossip to the police and get them to come quickly. That's not malice, because you want to save a person's life and save the person with the axe from doing bad karma.
So basically just with the right intention.
Exactly. The right intention means no malice, you're trying to help somebody. But a lot of times there is malice in your gossip. Have you heard what Tashman did? That's not here. And people love to hear rumors like that. Now that is malicious. So, use good gossip. Yeah, if it's got a purpose to it, to help people, to lessen suffering, that is fine. Right view regarding the five components of existence. Now this is the five khandhas. And sometimes you think they're the, what do you call the five khandhas? The five groups? What else is it? What's the standard word? So I use components of existence now. Anyway, sorry?
Five aggregates?
Five aggregates, yeah, that's the usual word. And five aggregates never makes much sense to me. Because in Australia, aggregate means the stuff you put in concrete to mix it up. So, instead, call it components of existence, which you put together and you get this human being as we know it. So, when we do translations, if you can find a word which is better than they used before, we use it. So, in order to take the understanding deeper. Right view regarding the five components of existence. You view your body as impermanent, suffering and non-self. That should be very easy for a doctor. We all know that one day we must die. Do you? So why is it that when the doctor tells you, I'm sorry sir, you've got a cancer, you've only got a week to live. Why don't you say, yes, I expected that. Then you'd be someone who understands the Dhamma. But, oh, I'm too young to die. Or like this person I was told, she was 96 years of age. Never had an ill day in her life. She went to the hospital to get some check-up, and they told her she had cancer. And as soon as she heard she had cancer, she said, why me? 96 years of age, she got away with it. And now at 96, she said, why me? Why not?
John?
Yeah.
Isn't
Vedana
normally translated as feeling?
Yes, but it's not an accurate translation. So I'm translating it as experience. Mm-hmm. That is much closer. Okay. But anyway, it's true. I'm changing these translations to make it deeper, give it another understanding, another more accurate sort of description. Mm-hmm. They regard experience. This is what you experience through your senses. That's, you know, we might say human beings. And we've got different human beings. You might classify them according to men and women, according to the races they come from. These days everyone gets mixed up, so it's really hard to say who's Asian, Caucasian, African. So we're all a bit of each these days, which is nice. So that's just the different classifications of human beings. The feeling, which is usually the pleasure, the pain, or the in-between, that is just a classification of just what they're talking about here, which is the experience of the world. How do you experience stuff? So you regard experience as impermanent suffering and non-self. Your experience of life. You know, it's always changing. And it's suffering, because you never get what you want. If you do, it doesn't last long enough. Oh, that's the nature. I almost get happiness, and then it's taken away from me. It doesn't last. And it's non-self. If it was mine, I could control it. I can't even control the monks in my monastery. Because it's not my monastery. It's not even my mind. It's not even my body. That's why it gets sick when I don't want it to. So, you regard experience as impermanent suffering, and the word which I think I said the first day, nanya. None your business. So my experience is none of my business. It just does its own thing, and I've just got to just go with it. I can't control it. This doesn't belong to me. You regard perception as impermanent suffering and non-self. And you regard will, that's the sankhara. Sometimes they call it mental... Mental formations, yes. But if you look, what the Buddha said, the main mental formation which he refers to is the will. And I remember I wanted to put it a mental volitions or volitional formations, but that is just too complicated. And if you don't agree with that, go and complain to Ajahn Bhumari, who convinced me. He's got a good point. But this is will. Get it clear so we understand what it really means. And he's got a point. So you regard will as impermanent suffering and non-self. And that's a very powerful translation, because we think that the will belongs to me. That you can control your will. Ha ha ha. You'll soon find out that your will, just like experience and the body, is out of control. That's scary. And it is suffering. This is one of the reasons I say don't put forth effort. In other words, don't encourage your will when you're meditating. You're encouraging something which is a problem. You let go, which is calming your will down. And when you calm your will down, then amazing things happen. And regard consciousnesses, not consciousness, but a whole six different types of consciousness, consciousnesses, as impermanent suffering and non-self. Because those of you who have done a little bit of study, there is sight consciousness, there is sound consciousness, there is smell consciousness, there is taste consciousness, and there is feeling, body sensation consciousness. And those are totally different. And there is mind consciousness. Six totally different types of consciousness. And if we call it consciousness, what people tend to think is some underlying, unifying consciousness which is being referred to. No, it's consciousnesses. Plural. So that makes it even so high. You can see with a bit of more accurate translation, you get far deeper understanding of what the Buddha is saying. That is right view. Unprofitable questions. It's good to ask questions, but some questions don't lead you anywhere. If anyone should say, I will not become a practicing Buddhist, and this is actually from the words of the Buddha, until I discover whether this universe is eternal or not, finite or infinite. Oh, that's one of the reasons why Stephen Hawking is not a Buddhist. I got that from one of his best friends, my friend Bernard Carr. He's still finding out, he's waiting until he finds out whether the universe is eternal or not. Finite or infinite, or whether my permanent essence and my body are the same. Instead of using soul or self, what it really means is there's a permanent essence inside of your body or mind somewhere. An essence of you. And that is pretty close to the word atta, an essence. And here the idea is that there's some essence in you which was there before you were born, there afterwards, which does not change. Everything around you, how it expresses itself, changes, but not the essence itself. So that's the idea of self. And atta, no self. But that, or no soul, so I used to call it no permanent essence. The permanent essence of my body are the same. Or my permanent essence is one thing, but my body is another. Or whether the Buddha persists after death, does not persist after death, both persist and does not persist after death, whatever that means, or neither persists nor does not persist after death. If any of you have been to India, you know that their philosophy is highly developed. And where we have two choices, they see another third choice, fourth choice, and this is one of the ones. It exists, doesn't exist, neither exists nor not exist, or not neither and neither of any of them together, whatever that means. And that person would die before they found out. Now in the suttas you may remember that wonderful phrase, a person shot with an arrow. That doesn't make sense to modern people. How many people working in a hospital have found people shot with an arrow? But, so, we use the essence of the simile, but just make it more relevant to today. Suppose a person was shot with a gun, and medics would come to help them. Then that person said, hang on a minute, who pulled the trigger? What type of gun did they use? And why did they shoot me? Moreover, let me see your medical qualifications first. I will not let you treat me until you answer all these questions. And that person would be considered to have wrong view. And might die before those questions were answered. So it's the same simile, the essence is there, but make it more relevant. Therefore, one who seeks their own... Hey, where'd it go? Too far down, I think. Oh yeah. Therefore, the one who seeks their own welfare should pull out this bullet, the bullet of unhappiness, pain and suffering first. For one with a view, the universe is eternal. The holy life is without meaning. It is eternal, there's no end of you. So, you know, why do you keep on practicing? And one with a view, life is not eternal. Again, the holy life is without meaning. You get no end anyway. Whether one has the view the universe is eternal or view the universe is not eternal, there is rebirth, there is aging, there is death, there are sorrow, crying, pain, unhappiness and distress, the destruction of which are prescribed in this very life. Pause there for a little bit. Any questions? Are you finding the revised translation interesting? Mm-hmm. I hope so, otherwise I'm out of here. So, okay, Scott, the five basic fetters.
Question.
Oh yeah, I'm making it.
Question on the last paragraph.
So scroll what again.
So does that mean even after you attain the right view, you will still go through rebirth and aging and death?
Yes, you'll become a screen winner when you get right view, and that's the first stage of enlightenment. It means that it's more rebirth for you, but only in, never again in the lower realms, but in sort of the human realms and the higher realms. And so those people who are screaming, to test your knowledge of the Dhamma, how many more lives have you got? If you become a screen winner today, maximum, how many more lives have you got?
60.
Ah, you've heard me before. You're too smart. Because sometimes people say 7 more lifetimes. But it means this one is the first and you have 6 more. Just like in Asia, when you are born, you're already 1 year old. So you're always older than I am. When you get your driving license early, always quote your Asian age. And also if you want to apply for your pension, Asian age. So anyway, that's because this life is one, you have 6 more afterwards. That's enough. Yeah. Is that okay? Look. 5 basic fetters. And a fetter is what, you know, it's like a ball and chain, it's something which drags you down. Here, one who has not seen the Dhamma, they call it Putuchana, ordinary person, abides with a mind addicted and attached to a view of a permanent essence. And they do not even seek an escape from the long-standing wrong view of a permanent essence. That's basic fetter number one. When the wrong view of a permanent essence has become habitual, it is regarded as a basic fetter. One who abides with a mind addicted and attached with skeptical doubt to a belief that rites and rituals are sufficient in themselves to reach awakening, to desire for the 5 senses, aversion, and they do not even seek an escape from these states, then when these states have become habitual, they are regarded as the five basic fetters. So those are the ones which keep you getting reborn again and again and again. The higher fetters, the last five, which you'll come across later, those are the things which you become a non-returner, and they just keep you from just the last full enlightenment. But that's such a small fetter in comparison to the rest. So unwise contemplations. Yes, sometimes, but why do we have these wrong views? It's because we don't look at the right stuff. One who has not seen the Dhamma, or does not understand what things are fit for contemplation and what things are not. Thus they contemplate on those things unfit for attention and not those things fit for attention. This is how you contemplate unwisely. Did my soul exist in the past? Did my soul not exist in the past? What was my soul in the past? How was my soul in the past? Having been what did my soul become in the past? Shall my soul be in the future? Shall my soul not be in the future? What shall my soul be in the future? How shall my soul be in the future? Having been what shall my soul be in the future? Well, shall I inwardly perplexed by the present, thus is this my soul? Is this not my soul? What is this soul? How is this soul? Where has this soul come from? Where will it go? Why are those unfit for attention? It's because every one of those types of questions assumes that the soul exists, only we're not quite sure where it exists or how it came from. A soul being a work of permanent essence. So it always assumes there is such a thing as a soul. Yeah.
So when the Buddha said permanent essence,
yeah,
he only means the soul, or?
Yeah, because to write permanent essence so many times in that, you know, it was just too much. So it's what a person assumes to be a soul, a permanent essence.
Because
the real you.
Because in physics, energy is never created nor destroyed, right? It's ever changing.
Yeah.
And that refers to a non-permanent essence.
Yeah. But now you've got into this physics question. This is not the energy to do with the mind, the energy of this universe. And it's mass energy, because you know that mass stuff can be converted into energy, energy into mass. That is the basis of the nuclear bombs, or nuclear energy. So, if mass energy can't be created or destroyed, where did this universe come from? It can't come from nothing, can it? Because you can't create energy or mass. But there is something in physics. It's called negative energy, and the best example of that, which many of you know, is called potential energy in your high school physics. If you remember that, a potential energy is like a massive object in a gravitational field. Think Ajahn Brahm sitting here. A massive object in a gravitational field. Now to send me into outer space, to get this body out of that gravitation, I have to lose a lot of energy. What would happen if the amount of energy it took to take me out of this gravitational field was exactly the mass energy of this physical body? In other words, I was a zero sum. My negative energy and positive energy totally balanced. And the story was, I was giving another seminar here in Perth with our local professor of physics, that was David Blair. And I said to him, what would be the case if all the negative energy in this universe totally equaled the amount of positive energy? So that if all the stars and the cosmic gas and the planets and the asteroids, if they all could somehow come together and they'd all totally cancel out. It's a nothing. And I remember that moment when he turned around and said, "My goodness, you're up to date as ever. Omega equals one." I got it. This is modern physics.
The big shrink, right?
Sorry?
The big shrink.
If it's a big shrink, it all comes together, a big whimper. Ooh. And that's that big whimper's whatever. If we get all the anything in this universe, it's zero. It came from nothing. It's totally balanced, the zero sum game, and if it all could come together, it would not explode. It wouldn't be a big lump of energy or big solid mass left. It would just all disappear. Nothing left. We come from nothing. We go back to nothing. And that's why somebody today at lunch over at Johannesburg, I told them one of the deepest sayings. And this is not from the sutras, not the word of the Buddha. This is the word you see on t-shirts. And it was, nobody is perfect. That was the first line. Second line, I am a nobody. At a time. Therefore, I'm perfect. And if you take that, nothing is perfect. There's nothing here, therefore this world is perfect. So if you want to be perfect, nobody is perfect. If you are somebody, you've got a sense of self, then you're not perfect, baby. So when you realize you're a nobody, no one in here, nobody's perfect, I'm a nobody, if I'm perfect. That's the Four Noble Truths, enlightenment. Okay, where are we going? Okay. The six views about the soul. When you attend unwise in that way, you think there's a soul there somewhere, you're just trying to find out where it is. It's just like searching for the Loch Ness Monster. Have you heard about the Loch Ness Monster?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know how much Scottish people like their whiskey? They invented it. So that was the origin of the Loch Ness Monster. A few Scotsmen a bit too drunk. Let's see anything. But we want to try and find it. And they've had expeditions. They've had sonars going to the deepest parts of the rock. And they haven't had any evidence yet of the Loch Ness Monster. They still keep looking. Just because they haven't found it does not prove it doesn't exist. It could be hiding. But that's a trouble with this idea of a soul. You know, is it this, is it that? If you think you have that idea, you can never disprove it. You're just looking the wrong way. So the six views about the soul. When you attend unwise in this way, one of the six views arises in you. The last one, number six, is the most usual one. But people are philosophical. The view, I possess a soul, arises in you as true and established. Or the view, I possess no soul, only a material body, whose conscious life is a mere byproduct of a brain, arises in you and true and established. That's modern physics. Possess no soul, only a material body, whose conscious life is a mere byproduct of a brain, arises in true and established. Or the view, I know the soul with a soul. Thus I know, therefore I am. Arises in you true and established. All the view, I perceive there is no soul with a soul. Everything I see is no soul, but underneath that, deep inside, there is a soul. That otherwise I can't know anything. So, I know what's out there is not a soul, but inside, somewhere, the ground of all being. The soul is, but cannot be seen. All of you, I perceive a soul I perceive a soul with what is without a soul arises in you as true and established. The five khandhas, that's the five components of existence, they can know the original mind. Or else, what most people do, you have this view such as this. It is this soul of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. But this soul of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. So, the idea of who you are, or rather what you take yourself to be, is so fundamental to any religious life. The Buddha said those are the six views which are all wrong. Now, this is the Buddha's answers to what is the right view, the truth. The true two extremes and the middle doctrine. Venerable Sir, he said, right view, in what way is there right view? The world, Kachana was one of the Buddha's monks, mostly depends on the duality, upon a theory of existence and a theory of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of phenomena as it is really, as it really is, there's no idea of non-existence of the world. You are listening to this, or something is, so you can't say there's nothing. There is conscious existence, experience. You can feel this. This is direct experience. You can't say there's nothing. And for one who sees the cessation of phenomena as it really is, there's no idea of existence of the world. As soon as it arises, it passes away. Most people are attached to one of these wrong views, but one with the right view disengages from such dualistic theories about my soul. You have no perplexity or doubtless confusion. That what arises is only suffering arises, and what ceases is only suffering ceases. Your knowledge about this is independent of mere belief and acceptance. In this way, that is the right view. Phenomena exist is one extreme. Phenomena do not exist is the second extreme. Without veering to either of these extremes, the Buddha teaches the Dhamma by the middle. A process. Not nothing. Not something. But the third way. A process. Not nothing. Many people who are accused Buddhists are saying, yeah, believe in nothing. There's nothing there at all. Nothing. It's wrong. There is something. Otherwise there wouldn't be any suffering. You wouldn't be here. But there's not something either. In between. Not a thing. Not total nothingness. But a process. And that process is called dependent origination. With delusion as a cause, volition arises, a cause and effect sequence. If there was a soul, a permanent essence, would there be what belongs to a soul, its attributes? Yes, venerable sir. This is a little bit of philosophy. You know a thing, but not what it is, but why what it does. So, a hammer. You know it's a hammer by what it does, what its purpose is. To beat on something. You know a chair, something to sit on. So it's by what it does. So it's attributes. So if there was a soul, would there be what belongs to a soul? It's attributes. Yes, venerable sir. Or if there were what belongs to a soul, would there be a soul? Yes, venerable sir. Since a soul and any attributes of a soul are not apprehended as true and established, then this basic belief, this is a soul, this is a world, after death I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, I shall endure as long as eternity, would it not be utterly and completely foolish belief? And what you said earlier about physics, you know, you can't say there's nothing in this universe, you know, sitting on planet Earth. But you can't say it really is something, because everything comes together and it all vanishes into nothing. Just like the material world. This thing called your five components of existence. They come from nothing. And they're just a process in the meantime. And they will go back to nothing. And a few years ago, actually just before I went to Indonesia some years ago, this friend was having an argument with me, and they were just a Christian. And they said, you know, I turned wrong. You have to admit, nothing is better than God. And I said, yes, I agree with you. Nothing, emptiness, the ending of all things, nothing is much better. And he said, that is not what I meant. Or what I meant. No. Anyway, let me go. such speculative beliefs are called a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a procrastination of views, a fetter of views. Because they seem to be grounded in reality, and they are a thicket. A thicket means like bushes. Really prickly bushes. You try and go through them, you get scratched. They're almost hard to get through. Those speculative beliefs are just a big barrier. The wilderness of views, there's nothing really helpful there. The contortion of views. Contortion, you have to twist this way and twist that way to try and keep that view. And the fetter of views, because they don't allow you to. Procrastination of views. I don't know why I put that word in. I think that was a big rebellious word or something. But it's just procrastination means like putting it off until later on. The fetter of views. Shackled by the fetter of views, the unenlightened person is not free from birth, aging and death. From sorrow, lamentation, pain and unhappiness and distress. They're not free from suffering, I say. Now, the unenlightened worldling might experience revulsion from this body, let its importance fade away, and be liberated from this body. In other words, you see this body. Why? Because growth and decay are seen in this body. It is born and it dies, that's obvious. So after a while, you don't really care too much about this body. But that which is called mind, or mentality, or consciousness, those words, if you want to know, are citta, mano, vijnana. The unenlightened worldling is unable to experience revulsion towards it, let its importance fade away, and be liberated from it. Why? Because for a long time, you have held, appropriated, and grasped the wrong view. This citta, or mind, or consciousness, whatever you call it, is mine. This I am. This is my permanent essence. I did put it in here, but that's where you get that story which every member of Edi Pasuko knows, the Indonesian, the Chaching story of the worm in the pile of cow shit. Oh, his best friend from a former life tried to save him. Say, come with me to heaven, I can take you out of your cow shit to this beautiful heavenly realm. And the worm said, before I go with you, friend, I want to ask one question. Up in this heaven, is there any cow shit up in heaven? Of course not! We don't have filthy things in the heaven realms. And so the little worm said, then I am not going. I like my shit. It's warm, it's fragrant, it's my home, it's my food. And that's such a wonderful story because you try to pull people out of their wrong views, but no. This is my shit, it's warm and fragrant. That's such a lovely story. Suppose a fire was burning in front of you.
Sorry, question.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah, go on.
Sorry, I'm in the back.
Yeah.
Are the masters? I mean, of I, you know.
Yeah.
This is in myself. I am. And
yes.
This is myself. Okay.
Yeah.
That free manifest will are normally quite difficult to differentiate. This is mine. Quite obvious. You know.
Yeah.
That this cup belongs to me. You know. That's
yeah.
One I. But this I am, and this is myself, you know.
Yeah.
This my, your translation says this is my permanent
yeah.
essence. How, you know, can you use one example to illustrate, you know, that free differentiation? I'm normally quite confused with that free.
Okay. Here we go, and the Buddha's answering your question for you. Suppose a fire were burning in front of you. Would you know that a fire was burning in front of you? Yeah? If someone asked you what this fire burnt in dependence upon, how would you answer? You would answer the fire was burning depends on the fuel of grass and sticks. If the fire was extinguished, would you know the fire was extinguished? Yes. If someone then asked you where that fire went when it was extinguished, did it go to the east, west, north or south? How would you answer? The question makes no sense. That fire did burn independent on its fuel of grass and sticks. When that was used up, not getting any more fuel, it became extinguished. it didn't go anywhere. So where does an enlightened one go after death? The question makes no sense. So this I am, what is this I? It just comes up because of five components of existence, cause and effect. When those causes disappear, your sense of I vanishes. It's not there anymore. So it's just a process. When the cause of that process goes, then you go to this. Later on, you'll find another little quote from the Buddha. This was to Agivachagota. And there, was talking to Agivachagota, and the simile was similar to this one. Actually, this is the real one. This is just an adaptation of that sutta. That suppose you see a candle flame. And what is a candle flame? And a candle flame is just the result of three causes. The wick, the wax, and heat. When they come together you have a flame. It has no independent existence other than the coming together of wax, heat, and a wick. If one of those is taken away, the wick is burnt up, the fuel of wax is exhausted, or the wind blows the heat away, then the flame is extinguished. And where does the flame go? Does it go get reincarnated in another candle somewhere? Does it go up to the heaven realm where all good flames live happily ever after? Or does it go to hell to join all the other bad flames which burnt down tower blocks in England? What does it do? The question makes no sense. It just goes out, that's all. So when you say, this I, you take yourself to be. When its causes disappear, then you, the I, vanishes. Where does it go? Nowhere. No more than where the flame goes. So how you answer the I am? The one of the questions in there, which is the right consideration, is not who am I, but what do I take this self to be? You don't assume its existence. This concept, this perception of an I, what exactly is it? What causes it? And that is dependent origination. The causes. A flame has three causes. Your sense of self has causes too. When those have been taken away, then you go as well. Yes?
Would it be in that case as well that it's a bit like Run DMC, he's a rap artist from the 90s.
He
was pretty smart, but he had a song, Me, Myself and I.
Yeah.
It Buddha just repeated a lot of words like that, like he did.
Yeah.
Me, Myself and I is basically just the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's just using different words for that.
Exactly, yeah. Me, Myself and I. We have so many different words for the real me. My soul, myself, my original being, whatever it is. But what exactly is it you're talking about?
It's just like sort of the question.
Yeah.
It's just repetition.
So one of the things the Buddha did was to look at it in terms of five components of existence. And each one of those you look at, what do you take yourself to be? And that's why we have the five components. The body, it's amazing how many people take the body as them, identify with the body. That's why you have these really drop-dead gorgeous girls when they're young, really fit and athletic young men, and they get into a lot of trouble when they get old, trying to keep up their image. And you can't do that anymore. You're old. You're fading away. So, it's amazing how many people identify with their body. It should be so obvious, you know. Identify with experience as well. That's why people have these bucket lists. They want more experience before they pass on. Me, I've had too much experience. It's suffering. So that is the... I said it amongst this. Absolutely true. Last week I was in Toronto, teaching at a conference, and my host said, well, you have a free afternoon, do you want to go and see Niagara Falls? It was just an hour or two away. Almost everybody who goes to Toronto goes to see Niagara Falls. I said, what do you want to do that for? Because I've had enough of experience. You see one waterfall, you see them all. As I said today, if you really want to see a waterfall, you don't need to go to Niagara Falls. Just up the road there is Serpentine Falls. It's not as popular, it's much more humble, you know, just a tiny bit. But, you know. See one falls. If you don't like that, just go in the shower, take the shower. So what's a big deal? So people always want more and more and more experience. For me, I had enough experience. So that is, we say experience is my permanent essence. Or, then you get perception. Now perception, just the way we look at things, we always think of something like bare perception, bare awareness. Direct experience. But any psychologist knows that what you are hearing is not what I'm saying. You filter it. You only hear half of what I'm saying. That is spooky. What you see with your eyes, you see what you want to see. If you fall in love, the one you fall in love with is the most beautiful being in the whole world. And other people, you fall in love with that? How many times do your parents say, I can't understand what you see in him? And you think your parents are crazy? You're the crazy one. You see what you want to see. And when you fall out of love and go through divorce, I thought, why did I marry that guy? I must have been crazy. Yes, you were crazy. And you can only see the bad things in him. Can't see the good things. It's great being a mum, because I know both people. They're really good people. They're not perfect. They've got their faults. But why can't you see the faults when you fall in love? You can't. Why don't you see their good parts? You know, when you get divorced and you hate the person. Like, how can you do that? They're not perfect, they're okay. But that's what happens. We see what we want to see. It's one of the reasons I say, you know, romantic places in the world, nightclubs, walk by the river, candlelight dinners, or add it a fourth now when you're drunk. Each one of those places, the first three are always dark. So you can't really see what you're falling in love with. And the fourth one, when you're intoxicated again, you don't really know what's going on. So it gives your mind the freedom to see what you want to see. This is my soulmate. We were meant to be. It was a partnership made in heaven. At last, this one man, can't believe some of the rubbish people say. She's about 50. And she said, I know he's out there somewhere. I know my soulmate, the one I'm meant to be, is out there somewhere. After 50 years you haven't found him? Can't you understand he's not there? You think we make a day because I feel like being romantic. I'm sure that somewhere out there. It's just not girls, boys have the same stupidity as well.
I think it's 4 o'clock now, do you
want to
continue?
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, better. So, where does the night one go after death? This question makes no sense. Well, I know where I go at 4 o'clock, and that's to do interviews. So that's enough for now. Views and discussions about the soul are coming tomorrow. Same place, same time. Any other question before we finish off? If you have it, write down a piece of paper, discuss it tonight.
Sadhu.
Very good. Okay, that's it. Yeah. Thanks, Venerable Mudita. Can you, does anyone want to just get Lee and Kohat to do this tomorrow? So, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's the tech girl?
Yeah.
We'll say the tech guy. So we've got a tech girl, so. They don't have to be sort of under 30. Now, I went to Facebook 2 years ago and you didn't see anybody over 30. Because it was crazy, I felt so out of place. Anyway. So, if somebody has got a bit, a few minutes. Sorry?
Yeah, she will.
Okay, very good. Excellent. So, okay, now you can do some meditation, have a nice walk, have a cup of tea, it's a few time now. And please remember, noble silence. So you are warned. No conversations, unless they're really important. And if you see somebody breaking that rule, and you tell them you're talking, then you are also breaking the rule. So, what you do, do you have this in Hong Kong and Indonesia, the one finger sign?
Yeah.
You give them the finger? So, if you see someone talking, give them the finger. This finger. Everybody knows that sign. That's all you need to do, to keep people quiet. After a while you get used to this. And if there's repeat offenders who can't keep their mouth closed, always talking, especially if that's in your cottage, let me know. We have what's called masking tape. We put it around their mouth, just a little hole in there, so they can have a straw to have soup and milky porridge to keep them going. We don't do that, but just please, try to keep quiet. Okay, very good. So see those in the interview, see you in a few minutes.